Macmillan Audio presents Halo Evolutions, Essential Tales of the Halo Universe. Read for you by Steve Downs, Holter Graham, Frank O'Connor, and Jen Taylor.
Pariah, B.K. Evanson. Prologue.
"Will you tell me your name?"
asked Dr. Halsey. She made no move to squat down in front of the boy, to smile, to do anything at all to come down to his level. Instead, she remained standing, her posture neither friendly nor threatening, but simply as neutral as she could make it. Her gaze was steady, interested. The boy looked at her from across the room. He was only 6, but the boy's gaze was just as steady as hers, though there was perhaps a trace of wariness in his eyes. "Completely understandable," thought Dr. Halsey. "If he knew why I was here, there'd be more than just a trace." He held his body just as noncommittally as she held her own, though she could tell by the tightness in his neck that that might change any moment, without warning.
"You first,"
the boy said, and then moved his mouth into something that could pass for a smile. His voice was calm, as if he were used to being in charge of a situation. Not afraid, then. Not surprising, thought Dr. Halsey. If the report she'd read was correct, he'd managed to survive on his own, in the outer colonies on the planet Dwarka, on an illegal farm in the middle of a forest preserve 100 kilometers from nowhere, for nearly 3 months after his parents had died. Surviving under normal circumstances on a harsh world still in the process of being terraformed was hard enough, but for someone who was barely 6 years old, it was inconceivable.
"I already know your name," Dr. Halsey admitted. "It's Soren. If you knew, why did you ask?"
"I wanted to see if you'd tell me," she said. Then she paused.
"I'm Dr. Halsey," she said, and smiled.
Soren didn't smile back. She now saw more than a trace of suspicion in his gaze. Suspicion that sat strangely in his face, alongside his straw-colored hair and his pale blue eyes.
"What kind of doctor?" he asked. "I'm a scientist," said Dr. Halsey.
"No," she said, and smiled. "I'm not a psychiatrist. You've been seeing a lot of psychiatrists, haven't you?" He hesitated just a moment, and then nodded.
"Because of your parents' deaths?"
He hesitated, nodded again. Dr. Halsey glanced at the holographic files displayed discreetly on the interior of her glasses. His mother had apparently succumbed to a planet-specific disease. Treatments were readily available, but a family living off the grid wouldn't have been aware of that. Instead of reporting immediately to the planetary officials, as was required by law, the boy's parents had dismissed the symptoms as those of a cold and had kept working. A few days later, the mother was dead, and the stepfather sick. Soren, perhaps because his younger immune system had adapted more readily to Dwarka, had never become ill. He had, according to his stepfather's dying wish, buried the bodies of both of his parents, then continued to live on in their farmhouse until supplies were almost gone, finally setting out by foot to cross 112 kilometers of blue-gray forest and arrive at the beginning of authorized farmland. Was she right to consider him for her team of Spartans? Certainly he was bright and resourceful. He was tough and clearly wouldn't give up easily. But at the same time, what would it do to someone to go through that experience? Nobody knew how traumatized he was. Nobody knew for certain what it had done and might still be doing to him. Probably not even him.
"Why are you here?"
he asked. She looked at him and considered. There was no reason to tell him anything. She could simply do as she and Keyes had done with the others and make the decision for him, flash clone him and kidnap him for, as she'd started telling herself, the greater good. But with the other children, she'd in part assumed they wouldn't understand.
Here was a boy without parents who, despite being only 6, had had to grow up fast, much faster than her other recruits. Could she tell him more? "The truth is," she said, "I came to see you."
"Why?"
he countered. She returned his even gaze. Suddenly she made her decision. "I'm trying to decide if you're right for something I'm working on, an experiment. I can't tell you what it is, I'm afraid, but if it works in the way we hope it will, you'll be stronger and faster and smarter than you could ever imagine." For the first time, he looked slightly confused. "Why would you want to do something like that for me? You don't even know me." She reached out and tousled Soren's hair, was pleased when he didn't flinch or shy away. "It's not for you exactly," she said. "I can't tell you much more. It won't be easy. It'll be the hardest thing you've ever done. Even harder than what happened with your parents."
"And what have you decided?" he asked.
"I've decided to let you be the one to decide," she said.
"What if I say no?"
She shrugged. "You'd stay here on Dwarka? The planetary authorities would arrange a foster home for you." Not much of a choice, she thought. He's between a rock and a hard place. She wondered again if she wasn't being unfair putting the choice on the boy.
"All right,"
he said, and stood up.
"All right what?"
she said.
"I'm coming with you. When do we leave?"
Later, back on board, when she spoke with Keyes, showed him the vid of her conversation with Soren, he asked,
"You're sure about this?"
"I think so," she said.
He just grunted. "As sure as I am of taking any of them," she said. "At least he has a notion of what might happen to him."
"That's an awful lot to lay on a child," said Keyes. "Even one who's grown up fast."
She nodded. Keyes was right, she knew. The terms for the test subject known as Soren were different from those of the others. He was coming into the program in a different way from the very beginning. She'd have to remember that and keep an eye on him. Chapter 1. What neither Dr. Halsey nor Lieutenant Keyes knew, and what they would never find out, since Soren, though only 6, was smart enough not to tell them, was what really happened to him during those 3 months alone. That was something that Soren, or Soren 66, as he would come to be called, didn't like to think about. It had been terrible when he realized his mother was dead, and that the reason she was dead was because his stepfather had been too worried about going to jail for his illegal farm to take her to a doctor when she got sick. By the time his stepfather was convinced there was no other choice, it was too late. His mother was already gone. But his stepfather had refused to face it. He moved Soren's mother's body into the box room and locked the door, telling Soren that it was not possible to see her, that she was too sick and needed to be alone to recover. That had lasted a few days, until finally late one night his stepfather had had too much to drink. Soren stole the key and crept slowly through the door to see her there, lying on a pile of flattened boxes, the skin of her face tight and sallow. She smelled bad. He had seen and smelled enough rotting animals in the woods to know that she was dead. He cried for a while, and then sneaked back out of the room, shutting and locking the door behind him, returning the key to his stepfather's bedside table, and then sneaking out again. In the kitchen he sat, brooding, wondering what to do. His stepfather was responsible for his mother's death, he sensed, and as far as he was concerned, he should have to pay. Just thinking about it made him tremble. Thinking this and things like it led him to get off his chair and take the sharpest knife off the counter. He knew it was the sharpest because his mother had never let him use it without her help. He had to stand on his tiptoes to reach it. It was big, heavy. He stood staring at the low flicker on the blade in the half-light and then slowly made his way to his stepfather's bedroom. His stepfather was lying in bed, still asleep, groaning slightly. He stank of liquor. Soren pulled the chair closer to the bed and stood on it, looming now over his stepfather. He stayed like that,
clutching the knife, trying to decide how to go about killing the man. He was, he knew, small, still a child, and he would only have one chance. The neck, he thought. He would have to jab the knife in quick and deep. Maybe that would be enough. He would fall onto his stepfather and stab into his neck at the same time, and then, before his stepfather could do anything, he would start running, out into the forest, just in case it didn't kill him. Fleetingly, the thought crossed his mind that to do something like this might be wrong, that his mother would not approve. But having grown up off the grid on the edge of the civilized universe, living under a man growing illegal crops and possessed of a mistrust for the law, it was hard to know where wrong ended and right started. He was angry. All he knew was that his mother was dead and that it was the fault of this man. Years later, when he thought back to the situation, he realized there were nuances to it that at the time he had no chance of understanding. There was something seriously wrong with his stepfather, an inability to face up to his wife's death, that had let him simply block the death out. Yes, he'd been wrong not to take her to town at the first sign of illness. But his behavior afterward had been less maliciousness and more a sign of how deeply troubled he was. But at the time, all Soren knew was that he wanted whoever was responsible for his mother's death to pay. He waited there, poised on his chair, for what seemed like hours, watching his stepfather sleep, until light started to seep in. Then he waited a little more, until his stepfather stretched and rolled over in his sleep to perfectly expose his neck. He leaped forward, bringing the knife down as hard as he could. It turned a little in his hand as it struck, but it went in. His stepfather gave a muffled bellow and flailed around him, but Soren was already off the bed and running out the bedroom door. He was just opening the outer door when his stepfather appeared, red-eyed and swaying in the bedroom doorway, the knife jutting out between his neck and shoulder a little above his clavicle, his shirt already soaked with blood. He cried out again, a monstrous sound like an angry ox, and then Soren had the door open and had plunged out into the crisp morning air, vanishing into the forest. He was well hidden within a clump of bushes by the time his stepfather came out, the knife out of his flesh now, and in his hand, the wound sprayed with biofoam. The man was grimacing, clearly in pain.
"Soren!" he cried out. "What's wrong with you?"
Soren didn't say anything, pulling himself deeper into the bushes. His stepfather came in search of him. Whatever was wrong, the man claimed, could be sorted out if Soren would just come out and explain it to him. He passed very close, so close that Soren could hear the ragged sound of his breathing. His stepfather nearly stepped on his hand, and then he continued on deeper into the forest, occasionally stopping to call out his name. That was as far as Soren's plans went. He couldn't, he felt, go back into the house, not now that he had tried to kill his stepfather. And yet where was he to go? They were in the middle of nowhere, miles away from anything. The first night was difficult, the air cold enough in the dark that he kept waking up, shivering, his teeth chattering. He kept hearing things, too, unsure whether it was his stepfather or the animals of the forest. And, if the latter, whether they were just small rodents or something larger that might be carnivorous. His mother had always warned him not to go far into the forest. "It's not like the parks back home," she had claimed. "It's not safe." He awoke at dawn, hungry and bone tired. He crept to the edge of the clearing and watched the prefab house from the safety of the brush, wondering if he could sneak in and get some food. He was getting ready to do so when he caught a brief flash of his stepfather through the window, standing just inside, waiting for him. He slunk back into the forest, stomach still growling. He wanted to cry, but the tears just didn't seem to come. Had he done the right thing, stabbing his stepfather? He wasn't sure. In any case, it hadn't worked. It only made things worse. He should have had a better plan, he thought, or at least figured what to do next. This was no time for crying, he decided. He had to figure out what to do next. The first thing was to have something to eat. He couldn't get into the house for the food in there. He should have thought of that before stabbing his stepfather, should have taken some food out of the house and cached it in the woods. But it was too late for that now. He would have to make do. At first he tried to catch an animal, one of the toothless, squirrel-like creatures that slid silently as ghosts around the trunks and boles of the trees. But after only a few minutes he realized they were much too fast for him. Next he tried to sit motionless to see if they would come to him. They were curious and got close, but never quite close enough for him to grab one. Maybe he could kill one by throwing rocks? He tried, but mostly his aim was off, and the one time he hit one, it simply gave an angry chitter and scuttled off. Even if I catch one, he suddenly realized, how am I going to cook it? I don't have anything to start a fire. What could he eat, then? Some of the plants were edible, but which ones? He wasn't sure. His family had never harvested from the forest, sticking instead to their prepackaged provisions. In the end, he stepped on a dry, rotten branch and heard it crack, an eddy of bugs pouring out of the gap and quickly vanishing into the undergrowth. He heaved the branch over and saw, along the underside, pale white larvae, worms, large-jawed centipedes, and beetles spotted orange and blue. He avoided the beetles. If they were that brightly colored, there must be something wrong with them. But tried both the larvae and the worms. The larvae had a nutty taste and were okay to eat if he didn't think too much about them. The worms were a little slimier, but he could keep them down. When a few hours had passed and he didn't feel sick, he turned over a few more fallen logs and ate his fill. Before night fell, he started to experiment, moving a little farther away from the house and making several beds out of the leaves and needles of different trees. One type of leaf he found raised a row of angry, itchy red bumps along his wrist when he touched it. He made a mental note of what it looked like, and from then on avoided it. He tried each of the other beds in turn until he found one that was soft and a little warmer. He was still cold during the night, but no longer shivering. He was far from comfortable, but he could stand it, and even sleep. In just a few days, he had started to understand his patch of forest. He knew where to go for grubs, when to leave a log alone for a few days, and when to turn it. Watching the ghost squirrels, he learned to avoid certain berries and plants. Others he tasted. Some were bitter and made him sick to his stomach, and he didn't return to them, but a few he went back to without any ill effect. He watched his stepfather from the bushes. He was there to see him in the morning, when he came out of the house and went to the crops or to the processor that refined them into a white powder, and there to see him as well at night. Each time his stepfather left the house, he carefully locked the door, and though Soren had tried a few times to break his way in, the windows were strong, and he wasn't successful. "Maybe I'll make a trap," he began to think, "something his stepfather would step in or fall into, or something that might fall on him and crush him. Could he do that?" He watched. His stepfather took the same route to the field every day, a straight and straightforward line along a dirt track his own feet had carved day after day. He was nothing if not predictable. The path was clear enough that there was little chance of hiding something on it or digging a hole without his noticing. Nor were there trees close enough to drop something from above. Maybe it had been enough, he tried to tell himself. Maybe he could just forget about him and leave. But even though he told himself that, he found himself returning, day after day, to stare at the house. He was growing stronger, his young body lean and hard, nothing wasted. His hearing had grown keen, and his vision was such that he could now see the signs of when something had passed before him on the paths he traveled. When he was sure nothing and nobody was listening, he told himself stories, mumbled, whispered fables, versions of things his mother had told him. Several years later, thinking it over, he realized that he had become trapped, neither able to go into his house nor leave it behind completely. It was as though he was tethered to it, like a dog chained to a post. It might, he realized when he was older, have gone on indefinitely. And indeed it did go on, Soren growing a little more wild each day, until something suddenly changed. One morning his stepfather came out and Soren could see there was something wrong with him. He was coughing badly, was hunched over. He was sick, Soren realized, with a brief shudder of fear, in the same way Soren's mother had been. His stepfather went to the crops, weaving slightly, but he was listless, exhausted, and by midday he had given up and was headed back. Only he didn't make it all the way back. Halfway home he fell to his knees and then laid there, flat on his stomach, his face pushing into the dirt, one leg jutted out to the side. He was there a long time, unmoving. Soren thought he must be dead, but then as he watched, his stepfather gave a shuddering breath and started to move again. But he didn't go back to the house. Instead, he crawled his way to the truck and tried to pull himself into it. When he failed and fell back into the dust, there was Soren, above him and a little way away, his face expressionless.
"Soren," said his stepfather, his voice little above a whisper.
Soren didn't say anything. He just stayed there without moving, watching, waiting.
"I thought you were dead," said his stepfather. "I really did. I would have kept looking for you otherwise. Thank God you're here."
Soren folded his arms across his tiny chest.
"I need your help," said his stepfather. "Help me get into the truck. I'm very sick. I need to find medicine."
Still, Soren said nothing, continuing to stand there motionless, waiting, not moving. He stayed like that, listening to his stepfather's pleading, his growing panic, followed by threats and wheedling. Eventually, the latter passed into unconsciousness. Then Soren sat down and stayed there, holding vigil over the sick man, until 2 days later, his breathing stopped, and he was dead. Then he reached into his stepfather's pocket and took the keys and reclaimed the house. It wasn't easy work to drag his mother out of the house and bury her, but in the end, his fingers blistered and bleeding from several days of slow digging, he managed. His stepfather he buried less from a sense of obligation and more because he wasn't sure what else to do with the body. He liked to tell himself in later years that he had buried him to prove that he wasn't like him, to prove he was more human. But he was never sure if that was the real reason. He buried him where he had fallen, just beside the truck, rolling him into a hole that was just deeper than the body, and mounding the dirt high around him. He stayed in the house for a few days, eating and building up his strength. When the provisions began to run low, he finally managed to shake the house's grip on him, walking out into the forest, making his way slowly in the direction that he thought a town might be. He was in the woods for days, maybe weeks, living off berries and grubs. Once he even managed to kill a ghost squirrel with a carefully thrown rock, and then slit the fur off with another rock to eat the spongy, bitter meat within. After that, he stuck to berries and grubs. And then, almost accidentally, he came across a track that he knew wasn't made by an animal, and followed it. A few hours later, he found himself standing on the edge of a small township, startled by how the people stared at him when he emerged from the underbrush, his clothing tattered, his skin covered with dirt and grime. He was surprised by the way they rushed toward him, their faces creased with concern. Chapter 2. With such experience under his belt, life on Reach in the Spartan camp seemed less of a challenge to Soren than it did to many of the other recruits. After living in the woods alone, he felt he was ready for anything. He was quick to figure out the best way through an obstacle course. He could fade quickly into bushes and undergrowth when on mock patrol. Camouflage was a way of life for him. He faded into the background too when in groups, wanting neither to come to attention as one of the leaders of a group, nor to be seen as an outsider. He stuck to the anonymous middle. But despite that, there were times when he noticed Dr. Halsey standing at a deliberate distance, watching him with an expression on her face that he could not interpret. Once, when he was nearly 11, she even approached him as he ran through an exercise with the other children, standing at a slight remove, as he hesitated, wondering which team to join. He couldn't decide if he was having trouble because she was scrutinizing him, or if he always waited until the last minute to make his choice, and it just took her presence to make him realize it.
"Everything all right, Soren?"
she asked him, her voice carefully modulated. Officially, he was now Soren 66, a seemingly arbitrary digit for recruits decided by the Office of Naval Intelligence for reasons they kept to themselves. But the doctor never called him by the number.
"Yes, sir," he said,
then realized she wasn't a sir, or even, for that matter, a ma'am, and blushed and looked guiltily at her.
"Yes, doctor?"
he tried.
She smiled. "Don't get distracted by irrelevant data," she said to him,
and then gestured idly past him at the two teams already running for the skirmish ground.
"And above all, don't let yourself get left behind."
Don't let yourself get left behind. The words echoed for him, not only through the rest of the exercise, but for a long time to come, haunting him long after he was sure Dr. Halsey had forgotten them. There was, he slowly came to sense, something different about him. Something that the other recruits either didn't have or didn't care to show. For that matter, he didn't show it either. As he grew, he was very careful not to let anyone see anything that would make him different, would make him stand apart. When he was very young, 6 or 7, he had been less careful. He hated sharing his room, found it exceptionally difficult to sleep hearing the sounds and the breathing of his fellow bunkmates. In their breathing, he heard his stepfather. Sometimes he waited until they had fallen asleep and then slipped slowly out of his bed to hide under it, sleeping in the damp, musty space near the wall. He felt safer there. But when one morning he had slept late and hadn't returned to his bed before the others had started waking up, the way they looked at him made him feel less safe. No, he would have to play along, would have to learn to go through the motions that all the others seemed to make so naturally. He wanted not so much to fit in as to fade in. But after a while, it didn't seem like an act anymore. He liked many aspects of the life of being a recruit. He enjoyed the challenge of it both mentally and physically. Having grown up off the grid, he had never been around people who were going through the same things he was. At times, particularly when they were darting through the forest together or crawling their breathless and silent way through a ditch full of mud, it was like being surrounded by many other versions of himself. It was comforting. Indeed, he felt closer to the other recruits than he had to anyone but his mother. Dr. Halsey, too, was the next best thing to a mother to him, though often distant, often preoccupied. But there was something about her that he found some strange kinship with. He still needed time to himself, still found himself figuring out ways of being off on his own, or, if not on his own, of creating a kind of momentary and temporary wall between himself and the others, as a way of trying to think, to breathe, to be more fully himself. He realized very early on that he was never going to be a leader. He was not very communicative, but his instincts were honed and good, and he was willing and able to follow orders. The others knew they could count on him. He felt in this the beginnings of a sense of meaning and purpose to his life, and he felt better than he had ever felt. He was keeping up. He wasn't letting himself get left behind. And yet he was still haunted by the past. Sometimes, particularly late at night in the dark, he couldn't help but think about what had happened when he was younger. He knew that whatever it was that made him different from the others came from that. At first, the past was something he tried to push away, tried to forget. But as he grew older and smarter, his thoughts about it became more and more conflicted. In his early teens, he began to see his stepfather less as a monster and more as someone who was scared and confused, somebody disastrously flawed, but someone who was also human. He fought against that realization, kept pushing it away, but it continually surged back over him. He had watched his stepfather die. It had been so quick, almost no time at all between the first symptoms and that strange transition from life to death, which made him wonder, with the disease that moved that quickly, could his mother really have been saved? All in all, he was neither the best nor the worst. He was a solid recruit and trainee, someone who, though haunted by his past, was doing his best to move beyond it. Perhaps, he thought, for the moment, that was all he could ask for. Perhaps for now, it was enough. Chapter 3. He was 14 now, and standing at attention on the other side of Dr. Halsey's desk. Her face, he noticed, was drawn and tight, her responses a little jerkier than usual, as if she hadn't been getting enough sleep or was overworked. She hid it well, but Soren, himself an expert on hiding things well, saw all the cues he was learning to suppress in himself. "At ease," Dr. Halsey said. "Please take a seat, Soren." "Thank you, ma'am," he said, and sat, a single fluid movement, nothing wasted. She was whispering quietly to herself, scanning a series of electronic files. The files were holograms whose contents were visible to her, but which he saw only as an image of a small brick wall, an image of CPO Mendez on the other side of it with his finger pressed to his lips. "Someone has a weird sense of humor," he thought. "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" she asked.
"Of course not, ma'am," he said.
"Dr. Halsey," she said. "No need to make me sound any older than I am. Do you remember when we first met?"
"Yes," said Soren. Hardly a day had gone by without his thinking about that meeting and everything it had led to.
"I wonder, Soren, do you remember what I said? How I gave you a choice?"
Soren wrinkled his forehead briefly, then the lines cleared. "You mean whether to come with you or stay on Dwarka? Or was there something else?"
"No, just that," she said. "You were young enough that I didn't know how well you'd remember. How do you feel about your choice?"
"I'm glad I made it," he said. "It was the right choice, ma'am."
"I thought we already talked about your calling me that," she said, smiling. "I wondered at the time whether I was right to give you a choice."
Lieutenant Keyes wondered, too, whether you weren't too young to have that burden placed on you.
"Burden?"
he asked. She waved the implied question aside.
"Never mind," she said. "The reason I've brought you here is to give you another choice."
He waited for her to continue, but for a moment she simply stayed there, staring at him, the same unreadable expression on her face that he'd noticed before, when he had caught her watching him during exercises.
"You're still very young," she said.
Soren said nothing.
Dr. Halsey sighed. "You've trained well, all of you, but training is only the first step. We're on the verge of the second step. Would you like to take it?"
"What is it exactly?"
"There's only so much I can tell you," said Dr. Halsey. "There's only so much the bodies that we have can do, Soren. So we want to augment them. We want to modify your physical body and mind to push it beyond normal human capabilities. We want to toughen your bones, increase your growth, build your muscle mass, sharpen your vision, improve your reflexes. We want to make you into the perfect soldier."
The smile that had been building on her face slowly faded away.
"However, there will be side effects. Some of these we know, some we probably can't anticipate. There's also considerable risk."
"What sort of risk?"
"There's a chance, a non-trivial one, that you could die during the augmentation. Even if you don't die, there's a strong risk of Parkinson's, Fletcher's syndrome, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, as well as potential problems with deformation or atrophy of the muscles and degenerative bone conditions."
He didn't understand everything she was saying, but had the gist of it.
"And if it works?" "If it works, you'll be stronger and faster than you can imagine."
She tented her fingers in front of her, staring over them at him.
"I'm giving you an option that the others won't be given. I am offering you a choice, while your classmates will simply be told they are to report for the procedure."
"Why me?" asked Soren.
"Pardon?"
"Why am I the one who gets to make a choice? Why not one of the others?" She turned her gaze to the desk in front of her.
her voice distant now, more as if she were speaking to herself than the boy.
What the Spartans are is an experiment, she said.
In every controlled experiment, you need one sample whose conditions are different,
so as to be able to judge the progress of the larger group.
You're that sample, Soren.
We're an experiment, he said, his voice flat.
I won't lie to you. That is precisely what you are, and you, an experiment within the experiment.
An exception to a rule, she said.
Why me? He asked again. You could have chosen anyone.
She shrugged. I don't know, Soren. It just turned out that way. He was silent for a long time, staring straight in front of him, sorting it all out in his head. Finally, he looked up.
I want to do it, he said.
You do? Said Dr. Halsey.
Even knowing the risks?
Yes, he said, and then added, I don't want to be left behind.
Strange, Dr. Halsey thought after he had left. What had he meant by not wanting to be left behind? Where had she heard that before?
She shook her head to clear it. Deja, she said. You were listening in, I take it?
Of course, Dr. Halsey, said the AI's smooth voice. Her hologram flickered into existence on the desk beside her. Created specifically for the Spartan project, her self-chosen construct was that of a Greek goddess, barefoot and holding a clay tablet.
Any thoughts?
Is that a rhetorical question? Asked Deja.
When Dr. Halsey didn't respond, she continued.
You didn't tell him everything, the AI said.
No, said Dr. Halsey. I didn't.
I would be remiss not to point out that, as the individual responsible for the intellectual development of the Spartans, you've given him faulty information about how a control generally works in a scientific experiment. The control group generally is the group that does not experience the conditions of...
I know that, Deja, said Halsey, cutting her off. Deja nodded curtly.
I would also be remiss not to point out that Soren 66 himself is precociously intelligent and has almost certainly realized that the reasons you gave for allowing him a choice were false.
And what were my real reasons? Asked Dr. Halsey.
I don't know, said Deja. I have a feeling, however, that I'm as confused about that as you are.
Dr. Halsey nodded.
But if I had to guess, said Deja, knowing you as well as I do, I would say that it was a way of easing your own conscience.
You just wanted to tell him.
You wanted to tell one of them. You wanted to see if just one of them would make the choice for himself.
Dr. Halsey sighed.
Yes, she said.
You may be right.
Thank you for being honest with me, Deja.
No need to thank me, I can't help it, said Deja. It's in my programming.
Dr. Halsey brushed her hand through the hologram and it disappeared. She leaned back in her chair.
I've given him a burden to live with, she thought. I've let him make his own decision. But Deja's right.
I've shifted the burden of responsibility back to him if anything goes wrong.
A child, carrying my sins.
Let's hope nothing goes wrong. Chapter 4. He was dreaming, but even in the dream, it was as if he couldn't wake up. As if he had been asleep for days and days. In the dream, he was back in the forest again. But in addition to the cold and the hunger, there was also something stalking him. A strange creature, almost human but not quite. Deformed somehow, its mouth cast in an odd leer, its body lumpy and irregular, dragging one of its feet behind. It was always just a little way behind him, never quite catching up with him, but he couldn't seem to shake it either. He could hear it there, crashing through the woods behind him. Every so often it would give a cry of pain that was so piercing that it was all he could do to keep going. How long had he been walking? He ate what he could grab from the ground around him and kept going, dead on his feet, half asleep, until suddenly he took a wrong turn and found the path before him blocked. And there the creature was, just behind him and on him before he could escape.
It plucked him up off the ground like a toy and hurled him. He smashed through limbs and branches and came down hard, the forest around him fading to white as he died. Only he wasn't dead. What he saw all around him was a blank, uneasy whiteness filled with a slow buzzing. And then the whiteness slowly resolved into a piercing light. To either side of him, dim shapes began to take form, resolving into heads, the heads themselves covered with white cloth caps, the faces hidden behind breathing masks. Beneath these heads, he saw, the clothing that covered the bodies was spattered and stained with blood. It took him a moment to realize the blood was his own. One of the heads was speaking, he realized, a low rumbling coming out of it, though he couldn't understand what it was saying. It stopped, and one of the other heads started to make a similar sound. What's wrong with them, he wondered, and then, what's wrong with me? Then a set of fingers waved itself over his eyes. He tried to follow them, but could do so only at a slight remove, his eyes moving always just a little late. A head dove down closer to his eyes, suddenly becoming crisply, painfully defined.
Is he supposed to be like this?
The head asked, its voice muffled through the mask. Then other heads were there, suddenly looming toward him, crisp and almost as if too close. There was a flurry of movement, too, shouting, and then everything became too slow. Everything moving oddly and slowly, as if underwater. This is real, he suddenly realized. This is really happening. Then abruptly the buzzing increased, and the thought slipped through his mental fingers and was lost, to be replaced by another dream. Another nightmare. In the dream he was sitting in a chair but couldn't move. There was nothing restraining him, nothing blocking his arms or his legs. He simply couldn't move. No, wait, he could move a little. Could move his eyes very slowly back and forth. At first the room was indistinct, as if the chair were simply sitting in the middle of a vast pool of darkness, but very slowly it began to take form around. Not a chair, he suddenly realized, but a bed. He was lying in a bed. How had he ever thought he was sitting upright in a chair? There was a blanket, he recognized, but he couldn't quite place it. The shape of the bed was familiar as well, the shape of the room familiar too, but he was unable to place where he was until the door at the far end of the room opened, and his stepfather, impossibly large, stooped and shouldered his way in. I'm in my mother's room, he thought, in my mother's bed. And upon thinking that, he began to realize that he wasn't the only one in the bed, that he wasn't alone. But he couldn't turn his head to see who the other person was. His stepfather stood in the doorway, more shadow than man, a strange piping noise coming from him, something with all the structures of a language, but impossible for him to even begin to understand. He appeared to be pleading, exhorting, but maybe it just seemed that way. And then suddenly the other person in the bed moved, began to speak in the same bird-like piping. And though he still didn't understand a word of it, he realized by the sound and tenor of the voice that it was his mother. She moved, and he saw just the edge of her hand, the skin, gray, and beginning to rot, to come apart, to show a thin strip of bone below. He wanted to scream, but all he could do was let his eyes dart frantically about in his sockets as she slowly shifted in the bed, her hand carefully feeling his face. She gave a low hiss and began to pull herself up. He was just beginning to see her face when a sudden intense pain washed over him, as if someone had worked broken glass into his veins. The dream wavered and spun and reduced itself to a small white dot on a black field, and then, with a hiss, was gone, leaving nothing but darkness behind. How long did that last? Impossible to say. He had no sense of time passing, no sense of anything but that limitless void, a vague sense of himself as part of it, but even that seemed to be blurring around the edges, any sense of himself as an individual being threatening to slip away. And then, very, very slowly, the darkness was broken by a small white dot. A dot which grew larger and larger, and in the end swallowed everything around him. And then it swallowed him as well. He awoke to find himself screaming. He was restrained, tied down to some sort of table or bed, and he felt like he was on fire, his skin itching and burning. The veins on his arms stood out and pulsed, and felt as if they were being torn slowly out of his skin. He flexed his wrist and pulled, and the strap around it started to tear. It felt like a series of plate glass windows were shattering beneath his skin, the muscles quivering and contorting over and into one another. There were men and women in white coats all around him, but keeping a little distance, except for one trying to approach him from just behind his head, almost out of sight, with a raised hypodermic. They were all moving slowly, too slowly, as if something was wrong with them, as if they were underwater. He tugged at the strap again and it tore like paper, and then he tugged at the other wrist and both hands were free. He was still screaming, couldn't stop. He reached out and grabbed the hand with the hypodermic in it and squeezed, was surprised how quickly his fingers reacted, and even more surprised to hear the bones in the man's wrist crackling like dry wood as they snapped. The sound the bones made was uncomfortably loud. He caught the hypodermic before it hit the floor, jabbing it into the neck of a man on the other side of him, who went down without a sound. The other hand was already tearing the straps off his legs. Some of the others had started to turn now, turning to flee the table, but they were moving so slowly. What was wrong with them? The pain was making it hard to think. He lashed out, struck the nearest one in the back with his fist, was surprised to see the man's body slam into the far wall and then collapse, leaving a blot of blood on the wall where he had struck. Then he was out of the bed and running for the door, but something was wrong there, too. He was having a hard time keeping his balance. The whole world seemed to be coming at him at an angle, and his legs weren't working in the way he expected. He was loping more than running, one shoulder close to the ground, steadying himself against the floor every few meters with an outstretched hand. He seemed to have stopped screaming, though sounds were still pouring out of his mouth, a kind of intense glossolalia, a language without meaning. He barreled through the remaining white-coated figures, and they scattered at the slightest touch, thrown to the floor, screaming and groaning, and then he was out into the hall. Which way? He wondered for the slightest fraction of a second, and then darted left. Where was he? It looked familiar. It was somewhere he knew, but the pain was still making it difficult to think. What had they been doing to him? He reached the end of the hall sooner than he'd expected and slammed into the wall, crumpling the panel with his momentum before turning left again and continuing on his way. Was the wall that weak? Yes, he thought. He knew this place. He knew where he was. The Spartan compound. And then a wave of pain burned through his head and he stumbled and went down screaming. Almost immediately he was up again, to the end of the hall, he remembered, then right, and then the outer doors. Then he'd be out and free, somewhere where he corrected himself, could never find him. An alarm was going off somewhere. The hall strobed with a red light, but the strobe, too, was moving too slowly. Again, he didn't stop in time, running into the wall at the end of the corridor and skittering off it before turning right and making for the outer doors. But between him and it was a line of 5 or 6 Marines, kneeling, pointing their weapons at him. And there, standing just behind them, hands on his hips, was CPO Mendez. "Stand down, soldier!" the man's voice boomed out. And for just a moment, Soren 6-6, hearing the command from the man he'd been taking orders from for more than a half dozen years now, slackened his pace. But the pain and the confusion, the sensation he had of being trapped, of being hunted, quickly took over, and he sped up again. "Stand down!" Mendez called again. Soren was almost on them now. He saw the muscles in the forearms of the Marines tighten slightly as they prepared to pull the trigger, and he suddenly found himself galloping on all fours, like a dog. As Mendez gave the order to fire, he leaped. He heard the shots, oddly muffled. It wasn't bullets they were firing, he realized, as he saw the blur of red flash by his elbow, but tranquilizer darts. They passed harmlessly below him, except for one that he felt stinging in his ankle. He came down and smashed into the line of Marines and was through them, tugging the dart loose as he made for the doors. He rammed into the doors, found them locked. He hit them hard with his shoulder, and they gave a groaning sound, starting to give. He hit them a third time, and at the same moment felt the stinging of tranquilizer darts in his back and legs. He bellowed in pain and frustration, and turned to find himself confronted again by the row of Marines. Mendez standing in front of them now, giving every impression of being in control of the situation.
"I asked you to stand down, soldier," stated Mendez. "Will you comply?"
The tranquilizers were starting to take effect. His tongue felt heavy in his mouth. The pain, which had been so visceral, so intense, was now receding into the background. He took a step, found his legs threatening to go out from under him. He started to turn back to the door, stumbled. The hallway lurched, righted itself. He turned back and found now, just behind the line of Marines, and out of breath, Dr. Halsey.
"Don't hurt him," she was shouting. "Please."
"Dr. Halsey," he cried when he saw her. "What have you done to me?"
Arms outstretched, he took a single step toward her and collapsed.
Chapter 5. When he woke up, he was in the brig, his wrists now in titanium wristlets, each of them hooked firmly by a titanium chain to a ring in the wall. He tested them. They were too strong for him to break out of, easily. When he stood, he realized there was something wrong with his legs. They were strong, the muscles differentiated and much larger than before, but the muscles had done something to the bone, twisting them, curving them in the odd directions. One leg was more or less normal, just a little bit bowed and twisted. The other, though, was gnarled and a good 6 inches shorter, and seemed more comfortable when folded up. That leg's ankle was rubbery and left the foot flopping. He could still stand, but only at an angle, leaning far to the side, and he was more comfortable, he realized, if he used a hand for balance as well. His arms, too, were rippling with muscle and seemed almost impossibly strong. They were, for the most part, fine. They were hardly deformed, relatively straight, but the fingers of one hand had become twisted and bowed, functioning now less like individual articulated digits and more like a single pincer or claw. "I've become a monster," he thought. He was still trying to take in his new body when the door opened and Dr. Halsey entered, an armed Marine to either side of her.
"Hello, Soren," she said.
He stood motionless, watching her. She, in turn, looked him over, both of them waiting out the other. Finally, she turned to one of the Marines and said, "I don't think I'll need you."
"According to CPO Mendez,"
the Marine started, "this is a science facility, and here I outrank Chief Petty Officer Mendez," she said. "I want you to leave." She turned to the other Marine. "Both of you," she said.
"Is that an order, ma'am?"
asked the second Marine, his voice calm.
"Yes, it is," she said.
The second Marine quickly saluted and went out. The other, after a moment's hesitation, followed.
"There," said Dr. Halsey. "That's a little bit better. I'm sorry about the restraints. They weren't my idea, but even I was overruled on that point. I'm afraid I don't have any means to remove them."
She came closer and sat down on the cell floor, deliberately within easy reach of him. If he'd wanted to, he could reach out and break her neck.
"Let's just do our best to pretend they're not there," she said.
Soren stared at her a long moment, then slowly sat back down, gathering his body awkwardly under him.
"How are you feeling?" she asked.
"I don't know,"
he said. His tongue felt awkward in his mouth, as if he was using it for the first time.
"Not very good. I'm having a hard time thinking."
"That's probably the medication," she said. "They had to give you something for the pain."
He closed his eyes, remembering how his body had felt like it was being torn apart from the inside.
"Is that normal?"
he asked. She shrugged.
"We're still figuring out what normal is. Some people seem to have pain. For some of them, it goes away. For others, it's always there. He nodded. We thought you were going to die, she said, and reached out to touch his arm. He let her touch him for a moment, then slowly pulled the arm back and out of reach. You've been comatose for nearly 3 months. Again and again, they thought you were going to die. It reached the point where we decided to disconnect life support. You flatlined for almost 4 minutes, and then your heart started beating on its own again. I wish I had died, he said flatly. She shook her head. You may feel that way, she said, but your body doesn't. It could have let go at any time, but it never did.
He tried to think that over, shook his head. He gestured at his legs, his gnarled hand. What happened to me? He asked.
Your body reacted badly to the muscular enhancement injections and the thyroid implant, she said. Basically, your muscles grew in ways and directions that we couldn't predict, and then tried to crush or twist the bones beneath them. We were able to use the carbide ceramic ossification process to stabilize and strengthen the bones and to stop it before it became too severe. But as you can see, we had better luck with some limbs than others.
She watched him and waited for him to say something. When he didn't, she went on.
Unfortunately, what that means is that there's a constant tension between your muscles and bones. It's like your body wants to tear itself apart. That may manifest itself as pain within the bone itself, as muscle pain, or as both. The pain may be intense, almost unbearable.
I know, said Soren.
With medication, the pain will be bearable. Some of us believe that as your body adjusts to its new state, that the pain might diminish or go away entirely.
Is that what you believe? Asked Soren.
Do you want me to be honest? Dr. Halsey asked.
Yes, said Soren.
Dr. Halsey sighed.
No, she said. I think the pain will diminish, but I don't think it's likely that the pain will ever go away.
He nodded, his lips a grim line.
On the other hand, she said, you're stronger than even we imagined. The straps on the operating table were strong, with a titanium microweave through the cloth. They were over-engineered to hold any of the other Spartans in place, but they weren't enough to hold you.
They were silent for a moment.
How many of us are left? He finally said.
She shrugged. More than half, she said. Almost half of you are dead. With another dozen or so, the modifications didn't take.
She reached out and touched his arm again.
I'm sorry, Soren, she said.
He refused to meet her eyes.
I made the choice, he said. I have nobody to blame but myself.
A moment later, she stood and, without a word, left. Soren stayed where he was sitting on the floor, staring. Chapter 6 A week later, he was out of the brig, released on his own recognizance. Some of the other Spartans he saw were in as bad or worse shape than he. Fajad had uncontrollable muscle spasms and was confined to a wheelchair. Renee and Kirk had had the same difficulty that he had, but their bones were so twisted and deformed that they were now floating in gel tanks, unable to move on their own. A few others were even worse, kept in isolation chambers, comatose, and always on the verge of death. Somehow he didn't find it comforting to think that their fates had been worse than his own. After a few weeks, the pain seemed to have diminished a little, though they kept him drugged enough that it was hard to say. The drugs did help with the pain, but he hated the confusion they caused within him, the sense he had of having to plow through ideas, of not being able to finish a thought. That started to get as frustrating to him as the pain had been. He slowly began to scale back the medication, palming a few of the pills each time he was given them, then more and more. The pain was strong and intense, but definitely slightly less than when he'd first awoken. He found he could stand it.
I can live with the pain,
he tried to tell himself.
What I can't live with is not being able to think.
Sometimes, though, he would make an imprudent twist, or just move wrong, and find himself on the verge of passing out, his forehead beaded with sweat. He kept at it. Everything felt rawer to him. But yes, he could stand it. His head was clearer in a way, though the pain, like the drugs, could make it difficult to think. Still, after a month, he was palming all the pills, pretending to take them, but instead taking them back to his room and dropping them into a drawer. In another 2 months, the drawer was almost completely full. It was true that he was insanely strong. Early on, in a fit of frustration, he punched the wall in his room, and was surprised when his fist tore through the metal panel as if it were thin plaster. He moved the bed so its post partially hid the damage, and was careful from then on out.
It's not hopeless,
he started to think as time went on. He was stronger than he'd ever been, faster too, despite his awkward gait. And even if his arms and legs had suffered somewhat, he still had everything he needed to be an excellent soldier, better than any normal, unmodified human.
I'm still a Spartan, he told himself.
But not everyone, he found, agreed. When he tried to report back for active duty, CPO Mendez took a long, hard look at him, and then said in a voice gentler than any Soren had heard him use, "Walk with me, son." They went down the hall together, an odd pair, Mendez straight and tall, his stride brisk and confident, Soren massive, but hunched and leaning, weaving as he went.
"Sweet William?"
Mendez asked him, taking out a cigar. Soren, looking surprised, shook his head.
"Ah," said Mendez, after first biting off the ends. "Sometimes it's difficult for me to remember that you're all only boys. Filthy habit, this. Don't start it young."
"Yes, sir," said Soren.
Mendez got the cigar lit and sucked on it hard. The end glowed red and then ashed over, the smoke slowly oozing out of his nostrils.
"I can't do it, son," he said.
"Can't do what?"
asked Soren.
"I can't have you in active service."
"But I'm strong," said Soren. "I'm even stronger than the other Spartans, and almost as fast as some of them. I can keep up, and I'm smart, and..."
Seeing the stern expression on Mendez's face, he let himself trail off.
"Nobody doubts your courage, son. And I, for one, don't doubt your ability. But if I put you in a team with the other Spartans, you know what'll happen?"
"What, sir?"
"They'll always be thinking about the ones who didn't make it. The ones that died while they went on. They'll feel a special obligation to look out for you and keep you alive that will affect their ability to perform. It'll hurt their focus, keep them from having that edge when they really need it. Right now, without you, they all move and think in a similar way. They work like a well-oiled machine. But there's something to be said for the symmetry they display, the instinctual camaraderie. You're good. No doubt about that. Hell, I could see that on the day you woke up and went apeshit. But being on a team with other Spartans just isn't going to happen."
"Respectfully, sir."
"Plus body armor," Mendez said. "It just won't fit you. Plus the difficulty of firing a weapon with that hand."
"No,"
he said, stubbing the Sweet William out on the floor. He reached out and put his hand on Soren's shoulder. Looked him straight in the eye. From his look, Soren suddenly could see how hard it was for Mendez to say all he was saying, that he wished things could be different.
"I'm sorry, son. Just be patient, and maybe something will come along for you. But this just isn't it."
"CPO Mendez is right,"
said Dr. Halsey, just as he'd known she would.
"He doesn't mean to hurt you, but he has to do what's best for the rest of the recruits, and for the program."
"But it's not what's best for me," said Soren.
"Who says it isn't?"
asked Dr. Halsey.
"It's not what you want, but that doesn't mean it's not what's best for you."
"I want to serve," he said. "I don't want to be left behind."
I'm sorry, Soren, she said. You can't serve in this way. You'll be able to serve, but not in a combat position.
All I want is to be given the choice, he said. You always were willing to give me a choice in the past. Can't you do it again this time?
She shook her head. I'm sorry, Soren. Not this time.
Chapter 7 Later, when he thought back to it, he saw that as the turning point. It shut too many doors for him, damaging him, closing parts of him off. And it was stupid, he tried to tell himself. They should have used him. They should have figured out something specially suited for him and his uniquely deformed body. It wasn't that he wasn't as good as the other Spartans. Even Mendez had had to admit that. In some ways, he was better than them, stronger. Sure, his skin and brain sometimes felt like they were on fire, but he was learning to control that, learning to get around it, and even focus it. They could have found something for him, something that fit him. But instead, they strapped him with a desk job within the compound, an ordinary run-of-the-mill job that just about anybody could have handled. They said it was temporary, but as time went on, it felt more and more permanent. Barely 16 and already retired from active duty, already a paper pusher. It was as if they hadn't even tried to think of the right job for him. It was hard not to feel resentful. Which was why, almost 6 months later, when one of the technicians, a fellow named Parch, began talking to him about revolution, instead of reporting the man, he began to listen. Parch started slow, just bits and pieces, hints. Sure, he said, the UNSC was much needed and important. We couldn't live without them. But didn't they sometimes come down too hard? Didn't they sometimes do things that were carried out with the best of intentions, but when you looked at them closely, were just simply wrong?
Like with you, for instance, said Parch, once Soren had confessed what had happened to him. Why aren't they making proper use of you? Strong as a bear, quick, smart, too. It's a damn waste, if you ask me. Yet they're still putting wet-behind-the-ears Marines right in the line of fire.
At the time, Soren didn't respond. But later, he couldn't help but thinking that, yes, it was a waste. Parch was right. Soon it wasn't just that he wasn't reporting Parch. He'd started to search him out. He listened, very rarely revealing what he was feeling about what Parch was saying, but listening. Listening. Finally, one day, he said,
So what can we do about it?
Parch shook his head.
I don't know, he said. It's hard to know what to do to fix the system when it breaks.
People are afraid of change. They'd rather limp on with a broken system than do the hard work of making a change.
If you're not careful, before you know it, you're labeled a terrorist.
But there must be something I can do, said Soren.
A guy like you? Said Parch, giving him a sidelong look. Sure. There's a lot you can do. But will you?
I think I would, said Soren.
Even if you knew that others might see you as a terrorist? Do you care more about what people think or about doing what's right?
I've never cared what people thought, said Soren,
lying. Parch gave him an appraising look.
No, he said. I dare say you haven't.
It went on like that for a long time, Parch talking and hinting, and Soren becoming more and more eager to take part. It was exciting, like he was part of something, like something was happening. As he heard news of the other Spartans, he needed that, needed to feel like he was involved. His allegiances changed almost imperceptibly, until almost before he knew it, he found himself on the side of the rebels. Yes, he began to think, the UNSC was too powerful for its own good. It had become a big bully. Yes, the colony worlds had the right to function in whatever way they wanted, had a right to be independent from the United Earth government if they so wanted. It was crazy to think otherwise. Yes, he was eager to help. Yes, and since that was the case, what was he doing here?
Be patient, said Parch. They need people like you. But we have to wait for just the right moment.
and let's take someone along with us. Something as a souvenir.
Chapter 8 Parch had a card that opened the lock. Whether he had stolen it or had been given it as part of his job, Soren did not know. Inside was some sort of geological research laboratory. On one metal table was a simple wooden box with a metal screen in the place of its bottom, a sealed plastic tub next to it. Here and there, loose on tables or bolted to the ceilings and the walls, were precision instruments, things mostly unfamiliar to Soren. They went in, Parch setting the door to stay slightly ajar behind them.
"Why not close the door all the way?" asked Soren.
"I'm not sure the card'll open it from the inside," said Parch.
"Stolen or rigged, then," thought Soren. "Never mind," he thought, then recited in his head one of Parch's lines. "When the government goes bad, we all have to do things that we normally wouldn't do until it's back on the right track again." "It's the sixth cabinet," said Parch. "I disabled the alarm this morning from my panel, and I've put in a loop for the AI to look at for the room and the hall. Not easy, if I do say so myself, and not something likely to last long. You think you can open it?"
"What's in there?" asked Soren.
"Something important," he said. "Something we need."
Soren nodded, staring at the cabinet. It was made of a brushed metal, perhaps steel, the doors seemingly quite thick. He reached up and put his hand over the top edge, felt the door's top lip, gave an exploratory pull. It didn't move.
"I don't think I can do it without a pry bar," said Soren.
Parch nodded, took a flat titanium alloy bar flanged at one end out of his backpack.
"You came prepared," said Soren.
Parch just smiled. Soren took the bar and forced the end of it in the slight channel between the two doors, grunting, barely denting the metal slightly to either side, working it in until it had gone as far as it'd go. Then, putting all his weight into it, veins popping out on his arms, he pulled. For a moment, Soren thought that even the crowbar would not be enough. He felt his arms burning, and a black hole began to open in his vision, the pain he always felt under the surface becoming reactivated by this new stress of muscle on bone. Then there was a creaking sound from the cabinet door, and it buckled just a little around the lock. He let up and forced the bar in deeper, then bore down again. The door creaked again and buckled further, then this time came free. He handed the crowbar back to Parch, who put it away, and then he opened the cabinet door fully. Inside was a titanium case, about 30 centimeters long and 15 wide, maybe 10 centimeters deep.
"What is it?"
asked Soren.
"What's inside?"
Parch just smiled. He was just reaching for it when they heard a voice from behind them.
"I don't suppose you'd care to explain yourself," it said.
Soren turned, his expression immediately going flat and neutral. It was one of the Spartans, not one that Soren had known well, someone he'd only rarely been teamed with before washing out. Randall was his name. He wasn't dressed in uniform or battle gear, was dressed down in a simple black t-shirt and loose gray cloth pants. His face was as neutral as Soren's.
"Hello, Randall," said Soren, thinking quickly. "Problem with this cabinet, with the lock mechanism. Sometimes it won't lock, sometimes it won't open."
"I know you," said Randall.
"Soren, right? Used to be a Spartan? But you're not a technician."
"No," said Parch, "but I am. The lock had frozen and I couldn't get it open. I asked for his help to unjam it."
"At this hour?" asked Randall.
"The lab is swamped during the day," claimed Parch. "They didn't want us clanging around during office hours."
Randall looked back and forth between them.
"All right," he said. "You don't mind if I verify, do you?"
"Of course not," said Soren.
"If we weren't supposed to be here, the alarm would have gone off," added Parch. "But no, by all means, you should verify."
Randall nodded, his lips tight.
"Let's go, then."
Soren immediately started for the door. Randall moved back and out into the hall to let him come, keeping a safe distance.
"He's smart," thought Soren, well trained.
He started down the hall, Parch just behind him, Randall taking up the rear.
"Where are we going?" asked Parch.
Nearest comlink, said Randall. Soren stopped and turned, miming a puzzled expression.
But the nearest comlink is back in the room,
he said, and then leaped. Randall saw the blow coming and shifted just a little, but still took a glancing blow in the shoulder. They tumbled down to the floor together, rolling back and forth. Randall kicked him hard and then tried to wriggle free, but Soren wouldn't let go. Randall was faster, Soren knew, but he was stronger. If he just didn't let go of his hold, he might keep the advantage. Randall kicked him hard in the face, but Soren was already working his way up the man's body. Randall kept kicking, trying to work his arms into position for a chokehold, but before he managed, Soren had straddled his hips and locked both hands behind Randall's back. He gave a shout and squeezed as hard as he could. Pain shot through his own arms and chest. Randall gave a groan and started to struggle harder, dragging Soren down the hall with him. Hold on, thought Soren. Just hold on. He squeezed harder, burying his face against Randall's chest as the latter pummeled his arms and head, and then tried desperately to reach behind his own back to break Soren's fingers.
Not the way you're used to fighting, is it?
Thought Soren. Randall was shouting now, then suddenly, he went limp.
Too soon, thought Soren. He's faking, and held on.
But Randall kept still. Parch, Soren realized, was talking to him, pounding him on the back, his face just a few inches from Soren's own.
What? Hissed Soren. Snap out of it, man. I tranquilized him. Let go of him before you kill him. Let's get out of here.
He turned his head to see the tranquilizer dart embedded in Randall's shoulder. The faked limpness. Carefully, he unclasped his hands and worked his way free. Randall was fighting the drug, not quite under, but could move little more than his eyes. Soren felt his chest, maybe a broken rib or two, but probably that was all, and he wouldn't be out for long.
Let's get out of here, said Parch again, and started down the corridor.
Soren took a last look at Randall, and then started after him. Parch moved in a rapid walk, fast enough to look to the compound's AI like he had somewhere he needed to be 5 minutes ago, but not fast enough to seem like he was running. Soren tried to follow his lead, quickly realizing he was heading toward the compound's airfield.
There's an older longsword, Parch said as Soren caught up with him. It's pre-prepared and hacked for us, complete with a dumb AI construct that I fast-grafted to convert him to the cause. We make for that and get in the air, get away from the base, and at the drop point, as fast as we can.